The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finland had for a long time advocated in favor of a NATO option, meaning that it could seek to become NATO's member if push came to shove. And I think in that sense, Finns were more mentally prepared to take the step compared to Swedes, where for example, we could just say that, okay, now we see that the situation has changed and it's time to materialize the option. Whereas in Sweden, they didn't have the option debate, training them and grooming them to become so to say, ready for NATO. And I think, as I said, when push came to shove, many Finns were ready to do the necessary movement, which I think, of course, was a bit surprising for the political leadership as well, but a necessary move in any case in order to get them behind NATO membership as well.
I'm David Preece, publisher of Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 25th, 2022. Finland and Sweden have made the historic choice to apply to NATO. But there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about the context for these decisions. So I brought together three new voices to the Lawfare podcast from Finland and Sweden to talk through it all. First, Manuel Ortengren, the acting director of the Stockholm Free World Forum, a Swedish foreign and security policy think tank. Second, Mina Aulander, from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, where she focuses on Northern Europe and Nordic security. Third, Henry Vanhanen, a foreign policy advisor to Finland's center-right National Coalition Party. We discussed the history of Finnish and Swedish non-alignment, the shift in public and government opinion toward NATO in recent months, and both countries' processes for applying to the alliance. It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 25th, Finnish and Swedish perspectives on NATO membership. Emmanuel, let's start here with Sweden and talk about the famously neutral position of Sweden for some 200 years, which has recently been manifested in non-alignment in the modern period. Talk through that a little bit for us and explain Sweden's security posture over the years up to the current crisis.
Well, I think Swedish non-alignment or previously neutrality has been kind of an illusion, to be honest, because ever since the Cold War, Sweden mm-hmm. has collaborated quite a lot with NATO and especially our NATO neighbors, Denmark and Norway. For example, there was a book that came out, I think it was published in 2011 by a Swedish journalist called Mikael Holmström, called the Hidden Alliance, which mm-hmm. uncovered this because a lot of Swedes actually didn't know about this. This was something that was kept secret even by the government because it was so sensitive at the time. And since the early 1990s, Sweden has been part of NATO's Partnership for Peace, along with Finland, of course, and so has become very much interoperable with NATO, conducts a great deal of military exercises with NATO. So, of course, neutrality or non-alignment has been part of the Swedish identity, I would say, and self-perception since mm-hmm. since the Napoleonic Wars and when Sweden decided not to join NATO in the late 1940s, there was a lot of references being made by Swedish ministers to this historic policy, and already then it was part of this Swedish identity, but in reality, we have always been closely aligned with the West. And even though the rhetoric has suggested. Otherwise, sometimes I think it is to a large extent an illusion that Swedes may now actually be waking up to. And I for one, welcome that. I know that it has been a divisive topic, but at the moment, there is a great deal of support in Sweden for NATO membership, although not quite as big as in Finland.
I appreciate your comments there, especially drawing a distinction between the political and the military alignments. That is a strong association with the West without a formal military alliance. But let me press you on one thing there. You talked just briefly about interoperability. Talk a little bit about that. During the Cold War itself, but especially in the, 30 years since, can you talk a little bit about the Swedish defense industry and how it works very well in tandem with the kinds of systems that we have throughout NATO?
Well, Sweden, because we decided to remain neutral, at least on paper during the Cold War, the Swedish government saw it as necessary to have our domestic defense industry, which is quite large. And I think it's only comparable to that of maybe the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China. And Sweden has, for example, a very, for its size especially, a strong air force. And yes. We also have submarines, which I think only Germany has around the Baltic Sea region and Russia, of course. So it was a deliberate choice. And at one point, Sweden even had its own nuclear program, but it was eventually convinced by the United States to not build its own nuclear weapons so as not to have any more nuclear states and add to the proliferation of nuclear weapons. But since the 1990s especially, and since Sweden has obviously become more closely aligned with NATO over the past decades, the Swedish defense industry has worked closer with NATO partners and has had to adapt its standards to those of other countries too. So it's all part of a process of closer and closer alignment with NATO that I think that you can see in the Swedish defense industry today as well. And I think that more steps will probably be taken as Sweden eventually accedes to NATO.
Mina, let me turn to you to ask a similar question from the Finnish side of things. Obviously not the same long history of independence as Sweden, but since independence, can you talk about the Finnish policy of non-alignment, including in the form of Finlandization, as it was called during the Cold War, but especially in the 1990s up to the recent crisis? Help us understand that period of how Finland chose to align itself or not align itself during that time frame.
Yeah, actually, it's like Sweden and Finland are two very interesting examples because they are kind of like similar but also very different in that for Finland, the reasons for non-alignment and also this kind of not really proper neutrality during the Cold War were way more pragmatic than in the Swedish case. It had way less to do with a kind of like identity or anything like that. It was basically just like the pragmatic approach, how to maximize national security vis-a-vis Russia as the dominating neighbor right mm-hmm. to the east of Finland. Mm-hmm. So basically, as you already mentioned, during the Cold War, it was in a way not really voluntary. It was after the Winter War and the Continuation War, it was kind of a necessary evil to like go into this kind of like status of being like retaining independence de facto, but actually having to consider the interests of the Soviet Union quite widely, which of course also included like military neutrality. And that is definitely the Finlandization period is definitely one that's not very fondly remembered in Finland. As I already mentioned, it was more of a necessary evil. After the Cold War ended, basically when Finland joined the EU in 1995, also back then together with Sweden, as always, the two come kind of in a two-pack. So back then the debate on NATO membership started also already. It has been discussed a lot lately this spring in Finland, whether actually this latest period of non-alignment was kind of like a remnant of the Finlandization period, that mm-hmm. Finland was still kind of like maybe over-considering the good relations to Russia and taking still into consideration not to provoke Russia. But I'd say that we shouldn't blame ourselves for not having chosen to join NATO before. We had this like a bit peculiar policy called the NATO option, which basically meant that since the 90s, just like Sweden, Finland has been quite deliberately seeking the closest possible partnership with NATO and like building the highest possible level of interoperability with NATO structures so mm-hmm. that we have been kind of like able to keep this NATO option on the table and open in a way that if necessary, we can like cash in that option and join fast if necessary. So I'd say that basically, what changed now is that it has become very obvious that like Russia is so unreliable as a neighbor now that no amount of self-restraint will guarantee your security. Mm-hmm. So both the non-alignment since the 90s and this decision now to join, I would describe them both as very pragmatic approaches to national security.
Absolutely. Henry, I'd like to talk to you about that aspect that Mina just brought up at the end about the shift. So when Russia invaded Ukraine again a couple of months ago, public opinion in Finland changed dramatically and quickly. Can you tell us where public opinion and government opinion was on the issue of NATO membership specifically last year? And then how it changed to the beginning of this year with Russian threats, and then how it changed after Russia sent its troops into Ukraine?
Well, of course, I would say that obviously the shift in public opinion is, as described, as dramatic. From a relatively stable support of around 20 to 25% for decades or even lower, to going up to what we have seen now, 76% in just a matter of a couple of months. And obviously, that represents a big change. I would say that, of course, the main catalyst has been Russia's attack, probably juiced with the atrocities that the Russian army has done against the Ukrainian citizens. I think many Finns woke up to the reality that regardless of us trying to have a good neighborly relationship with Russia, that this relationship is fundamentally imbalanced, meaning that Russia could respect Finland's position as a non-military, non-aligned country to a certain degree. But then there is a point that beyond Russia can walk also, that it doesn't necessarily respect Finland's position. I think many Finns understood this as well. But I would also note that we often talk about the February 24th, which of course has been the main catalyst. But we already saw Russia's military buildup in around Ukraine beginning late last year in the turn of November and December. And already by then in Finland, we started seeing a debate rising and rising. Now, I've usually said that the Finnish NATO debate is like an interval run. It sometimes takes spikes and sometimes then it cools down and goes down. And usually it follows the cycles in international security. When something happens, then it goes up for a bit, and then it goes down. And I think this was, for example, the case in 2014 with Russia's first war in Ukraine, that the Finnish mm-hmm. NATO debate took off a bit, but not too much. It didn't really go into a position where we would discuss the acute need for a membership like now. But still, I would say that in this case, in December, January, especially after the president of Finland gave his widespread acclaimed New Year's speech, where he said that one has to know when to hurry and when to have patience, I think people started really talking about the possibility of Finland joining NATO. And of course, afterwards, we've seen interviews by the president and, for example, the Finnish ambassador to the United States saying that already when Russia started indicating its demands that NATO should not enlarge anymore, that Finns and especially the leadership started to change their opinion. but that really didn't really apply to the Finnish people. Of course, we saw a minor jump in the polls going up to, I think, about 28% in favor in January. But it was only after the attack when we saw the jump going up to first 50, then 60, and now 70, and probably even more as the process goes along. One significant difference compared to Sweden is that it's like Minna said, that Finland had for a long time advocated in favor of a NATO option, meaning that it could seek to become NATO's member if push came to shove. And I think in that sense, Finns were more mentally prepared to take the step compared to Swedes, where, for example, we could just say that, okay, now we see that the situation has changed and it's time to materialize the option. Whereas in Sweden, they didn't have the option debate training them and grooming them to become, so to say, ready for NATO. And I think, as I said, when push came to shove, then many Finns were ready to do the necessary movement, which I think, of course, was a bit surprising for the political leadership as well, but a necessary move in any case in order to get them behind NATO membership as well.
Yes. Your phrase, when push came to shove, reminds me of the commentary that you've just published by that name, Finland and NATO, when push came to shove. And in that commentary that you've published online, you make the point that the fierce resistance of the Ukrainians actually have a crucial role here with Finland's application to NATO, because if Russia had succeeded in marching into Kyiv in days, Finland's current position would have been very uncomfortable and a bit more difficult, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's the alternative reality that we don't really want to think about right now. What would have been if things had gone as Putin thought they would be, that right. They would be able to take Kyiv quickly and swiftly, and then we would have a Putin in a full sentiment of power, which I think would have put Finland and the other countries in a position, especially countries that are military non-aligned, that they would feel more threatened. Because, of course, then Russia would think that it can move borders and attack countries. And if it resorts into military means, it gets results. I think this would have been a dangerous example for European security for decades to come. So I think one must remember that the Ukrainians' resistance, as I mentioned in the commentary, actually played time, and also played time significantly to change the mindset in many Western countries about how they're going to address Russia, especially from a strategic perspective.
Mm-hmm. Back to you, Emmanuel. How did Swedish public opinion and leadership opinion change from late 2021 to early 2022, and then, of course, to now, especially on the issue of seeking NATO membership?
Much more slowly than in Finland. And I think the difference, as Minna and Henry have both alluded to already, between Sweden and Finland is that while non-alignment has been more of a pragmatic solution to Finland's security dilemma, in Sweden it has been more of an ideological stance and part of Swedish identity, especially within the Social Democratic Party, which has ruled Sweden for most of the last few decades. Mm-hmm. I remember in the early days of Russia's full-scale invasion on Ukraine, you had the defense minister saying that it was disinformation coming from the opposition leader of the Liberal Conservative Party, the moderates, when he said that he thought that the Social Democrats would eventually change their mind about NATO. And there was also a very unfortunate comment by the Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson, who eventually did change her mind about NATO and made her party change their minds about NATO as well, saying that a Swedish NATO application might destabilize the security situation in Northern Europe, which she received criticism regarding from Finnish security experts as well. So for the Social Democrats, they've had this self-image of themselves as being the standard bearers of non-alignment. And this goes back, I think, to like the legacy of leaders such as Olof Palme, who was, you know, in rhetoric, very harsh against the United States and the war in Vietnam in particular. But on the other hand, also had a close security relationship with the US, and one that was also built on a substantial amount of spending on defense. I think Sweden spent 3-4% of our GDP on defense during the Cold War. So in a way, the shift was harder in Sweden because it was tied to the ideology and the identity of the ruling party in a different way than I think it was in Finland. So it wasn't really until maybe, I would say, late March, early April, that we started seeing some signs coming from the government that they were changing their mind. And I think the crucial factor in their shift was Finland's stance. And I think that if it hadn't been for Finland changing their mind, I don't think Sweden would have done so either, because the strongest argument against NATO membership in Sweden was for a long time the fact that it would put Finland in a very vulnerable position, and during the Cold War that it would, in fact, you know, potentially it would draw the iron, a new iron curtain that would border Sweden more or less if the Soviet influence over Finland became even greater. So Finland has always been part of Sweden's security equation, if you will. And I think that this has been reflected in this process as well. And it caught a lot of Swedes by surprise that Finland was actually the ones leading the way toward NATO, because only a few years ago, I think that this debate was probably more intense in Sweden than it was in Finland. There was the previous leader of the major opposition party, the moderates, who said after the annexation of Crimea that she thought that Sweden should join NATO. And at that point, it was the other way around. So this has caught a lot of Swedes by surprise.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because we have had voices in Sweden and Finland arguing for NATO membership for quite some time. And on this podcast, we had the former Prime Minister Alexander Stubb was on talking to us about this. Now, he is not out there saying, "I told you so." And I don't hear too many other voices out there casting blame for waiting. In fact, it seems like it has been a very civil process in both countries. Mina, let me ask you about that from a more personal view here, because you live and work in Germany, but you are now back in Finland. Have you been talking with people around you there about Russia's actions and about NATO? And how do people feel about this, which is very important to us looking at geopolitics and geostrategy, but to the population there that you're talking to upon your return, what are they saying and feeling about this?
Well, basically, people are very pragmatic about it, just as I emphasized earlier. When this moment came, as Henry also already explained, I think a lot of Finns were just like, okay, this moment came now that we have always kind of been anticipating. In a way, the Finnish kind of pessimistic mentality, overall mentality, can be explained by the geopolitical location, because there's always this kind of sense of preparing for the worst case. And
I wouldn't call that pessimism, Mina. I would say that is stark realism.
Yeah, let's put it that way. Well, yeah, that's maybe a better phrase. Anyway, so basically this idea that you're always kind of preparing for the worst case, and you're like happy when nothing happens and everything goes well. But when and like if and when the worst case actually happens, then you're also not surprised by it, really. Of course, like a lot of Finns were very shocked about Russia actually going so far, and the further the war has proceeded, about the terrible brutality of Russian warfare in Ukraine. That has been definitely like a great shock to many, mm-hmm. although it, like, in a way it has been a shock but not really a surprise, I would say. So a lot of people just have this kind of like calm determination. Of course, like especially in the beginning, I think like people were also worried because it created this like huge insecurity. But because of the Finnish preparedness, and because we have never like left Russia out of sight, there's not much that Russia can really do right now to intimidate Finland. Mm-hmm. So people are more like, kind of like also maybe in a way relieved that that now we can actually call the things by their names, and we can actually say, yes, Russia is, of course, the number one threat to Finland, has always been, will always be. Mm-hmm. And like when I talk with my friends who have nothing to do with politics or like security policy, they are also just like, they are like, yeah, good that we're like getting things done and we're prepared, like bring it on, kind of. And I have had some conversations, like really casual small talk conversations with my friends about like, what would we do like in the case? Kind of, and everyone knows what the case is. People are also preparing a bit more than normally, like having supplies at home, like which is anyways recommended by the Finnish government that everyone should have, like for 72 hours supplies. Right. But there's like maybe a little bit more of that kind of like preparedness also among the normal people. So that's what I see. But like life just goes on like pretty normally, and I don't feel any kind of like big worries or anything really, because there's this strong confidence in Finnish preparedness as well. Like Absolutely. We know what we're doing.
Absolutely.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Henry, could you walk us through the actual process of Finland's application to NATO, starting with, I think it was the president and the prime minister back on May 12th, announcing the intention to apply, but then it made its way through parliament. And I'm wondering if you can describe the steps that took and how it got from a discussion and a notice of the change in public opinion, how that got translated through government action to the formal application.
Well, as someone with a contemporary history background, I would say that it's up to the scholars and researchers to make the full image of the details of what exactly happened during these decisive months. But I can say this then, as we saw the attack in Ukraine, I think some of the political leadership were prepared for this to become reality and also for what it could possibly mean for Finland. And of course, potentially this meant that NATO membership was an option on the table, even though it wasn't really that for the public debate yet. The biggest shift, of course, was already after 2 weeks into the war, we saw a popular opinion jumping up to 50%. But at the same time, I think we also must remember that there was a very cautious voice in the West regarding NATO enlargement, especially after the first weeks into the war. I think the mood was more observing in the sense that we must take a look at what is going to be the development of this war, how long it will take, will there be a ceasefire or a peace process, and as soon as we have a better view of that, then we can address the NATO enlargement issue. So Finland also resorted into some sort of strategic patience in the sense that it did not pressure its partners to now accept it quickly into NATO, etc. And I think we also must remember that within a couple of weeks, things can develop quite quickly under circumstances like these. They can actually expire or develop or spin out of control. Well, at least we saw the expiration of circumstances and thinking in the West, because as soon as people understood that this war is going to drag on for months and we are not going to see how long it will take, I think the mood in the West changed to causing strategic losses for Russia. And meaning, of course, the NATO enlargement would now be seen as a non-escalatory move, but instead a strategic loss for Russia. That, of course, changed Finland's position as well, from a careful to a more, not vocally, very, I would say, rapidly evolving stance on joining NATO. I think it was only in the early May when we publicly said that we are going to apply for NATO. But I think at that point, it has been, if I look at, for example, my old tweets and remarks from early March, midway March, I think already by then the mood was that we're going to join NATO. But it's, of course, we must remember it was a two-track process. Number one, of course, being the domestic track that we have to give room for the public debate and also the Finnish parliamentary parties to evolve their NATO stance. But at the same time, there was this international track of trying to have preliminary discussions with NATO members and member states about potentially joining NATO and how would they feel about this. Would this be an issue for them or perhaps would they support it? And I think Finland did not want to move until it was certain that all these different tracks were covered in the best possible way. You know, it also, the domestic track involves preparedness, civil preparedness, military preparedness for different scenarios. Mm-hmm. And I think Finland did a very thorough working out this international domestic process. And I think they also wanted to postpone the sort of actual public information about applying for NATO because they wanted to, of course, give time for others, but also vis-a-vis Russia, that as soon as it's formal, then it probably will start seeing reactions as we have now seen. I would still say that, to sum up, that if you think about this process, it was only 3 months in which Finland quickly was able to do a thorough preparation domestically and internationally to join NATO and also get security assistance and security assurances from, for example, the United Kingdom, the US, the French, the Germans, and now we have seen the Nordic countries and Polish countries, Poland as well. So right. I think this has been quite a substantial and a skillful diplomatic play, not only because of, you know, as I mentioned, not only due to Finland's own skills and being able to seize the moment, but also because how things evolved. It led to an opening, an open window, which Finland, of course, then walked through when the time came.
Right. And as part of that international process, of course, consultations with the Swedish government. Emmanuel, play the flip side of Henry's commentary here. What was the Swedish process of decision-making here and going through the choice not to put it to a referendum, the choice to make a government decision? How similar and different were these dynamics in Sweden on the road to the formal application to NATO?
Well, I would say that the Finnish process has been broader. It has involved several committees in Parliament, for example, whereas the Swedish process that eventually led to a report that was published a few weeks ago, it comprised a smaller group of MPs. So, whereas in Finland, from what I understand, the more parts of Parliament, so to speak, were involved, and it was led mostly by the government, and then the process has also in Sweden to a large extent revolved around one party, which is the Social Democrats, who have had their own internal, they call it a security policy dialogue, where they've had to tell members about, you know, what move they are considering. I think not a single minister before a decision was actually made came out with their opinion, what they actually thought. And that was actually similar to what happened in Finland, where the president and the prime minister also didn't really reveal their own opinions until the very end of the process. But for the Social Democrats in particular, this has been painful because of the legacy of leaders like Olof Palme that I referred to earlier. So but the main difference is that in Sweden, it has been a narrower process in the sense that it has involved fewer MPs and revolved to a large extent around one party. And then another thing you could say about the Swedish debate regarding whether we should have a referendum or not is that there were parties that suggested that, especially the left party and originally also the Sweden Democrats, our nationalist party, but it was never taken very seriously by other parties for much the same reasons as it did in Finland, and that is also my personal opinion. I think it is very hard to vote or to have a referendum on security policy because there are certain details and certain pieces of information that you would need to know in order to make an informed decision that is very hard to share with the public. And therefore, it is, in my view, better also from a democratic perspective to have that process be led by politicians who receive information that shouldn't be spread too widely. So I'm sure that has influenced a lot of social democrats in particular who probably received some intelligence and other information that hasn't been shared publicly to have convinced them that Sweden should join NATO. And I do think that the Finnish process has also been very important, especially that Finland has had, you know, they've every step of the way the Finns have been present here. For example, when the Finnish security policy report was published in April, at the same time as it was being presented in Parliament, the Finnish Prime Minister Sanna Marin was here in Stockholm, mm-hmm. side by side with Magdalena Andersson, and I think that was important for both countries. And I should also say that we are grateful that the Finns didn't repeat what we did to them in the early 90s, when Sweden didn't properly inform Finland that we would join the EU, which is Finland could easily have done the same to us, and we're grateful that they did not this time.
Everyone taking the high road.
Yeah,
there is one difference, of course, in government matters between Sweden and Finland, which is that Sweden is a monarchy. And I'm wondering, I'm going to put you on the spot here, Emmanuel. Is there a formal role for Carl Gustaf, for the monarchy, in something like applying to an international treaty that will require a mutual defense guarantee to others?
No, not really. It is a constitutional monarchy, and I think the Swedish monarch has even less powers than say the British, and also doesn't have a part in. I know that in Denmark, if you want to form a government, and that's the same in the UK, you have to have a meeting with the monarch. But in Sweden, that is up to the Speaker of the Parliament to do that, and the King, and eventually there will be a Queen in his place. They usually lead a particular gathering consisting mostly of party leaders, where they discuss matters of foreign policy. But that is mostly just to inform, and he right. doesn't really have a part in the decision making process. And in Finland, it's very different, of course, because you have an elected president who also has a lot of, I think, and Henry and Minna can correct me if I'm wrong, but the Finnish president has. Foreign policy is one of the areas where he or she has the most responsibility. So mm-hmm. so it's very different from Sweden, where it is essentially the prime minister and the government as a collective that can enter these kinds of treaties, such as the one with NATO.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Mina, you have done a remarkable job recently at producing quite clear Twitter threads debunking myths about Finnish defense and security overall, with particular reference to the movement towards NATO membership, but extending beyond that. And I'm wondering if you can share with us perhaps your number one or perhaps your top two, the things that bother you the most that you're seeing out there in the international commentary about Finland, misunderstandings about Finland's defense and security posture.
Yes, thanks. If I may add just one point to what Henry was talking about earlier,
please.
I would just like to add that I think the Finnish kind of multi-step process towards the final decision to apply to NATO was probably pretty confusing to a lot of international observers, because there was kind of the past 2 weeks there was one big announcement after another, mm-hmm. and everyone was like, oh my god, okay, now Finland announced the intention to apply to NATO, and then there was another announcement, and now there's the parliamentary debate, and now they're also debating for hours on end, and that was probably very confusing to many, because basically it was already a done deal at that point. But I would just like to add the explanation that is kind of a part of the Finnish concept of comprehensive security, which encompasses whole of society, mm-hmm. Includes business, economy, infrastructure, civil defense, everything. So I think it was a very important part of the Finnish process to have not to skip all any of these democratic and parliamentary steps, although the parliament actually wasn't constitutionally needed at this point yet. the president and prime minister could have like triggered the application process on their own. Correct me if I'm wrong, Henry, but I think this is the case. But it was very important in Finland to secure the broadest possible consensus on this matter, because it's like, because national security is such a crucial part of Finnish politics. So anyways.
Actually, I'll back you up on that comment, because seeing the headlines of the major news media in the United States, at least, there were several days in which the headlines were Finland joining NATO. Even if it wasn't that dramatic, it was Finland applies to NATO, but it was jumping the gun a bit. It was not accurately reflecting that every step in the process had been done. So many people in the United States wondered why there was news on one day that Finland was applying to NATO, and then several days later, there was news that now Finland was applying to NATO. So I can back you up on that.
Yeah, I can totally imagine. And that's actually also a nice bridge to what you actually wanted to ask me, because I think there are like quite a lot of widespread misconceptions about the Finnish motivation to join NATO. Basically, what I think is the most important thing to know is that Finland is not applying in order to outsource its defense, its national defense to NATO. Mm-hmm. So the idea is not that, like, next thing you know, American soldiers will be posted at the 1,400 kilometers border between Finnish and Russia, but that Finland, like, definitely has the capabilities and the will to defend the border regardless of NATO membership. It's more of an insurance, you know, like kind of like an extra insurance, which is intended to make the stakes of like military action against Finland as high as possible. So in a way, if you see that your neighbor's house is burning because someone set it on fire, then it's like reasonable that you will want to make an insurance for your house. So that's basically like what describes the Finnish like motivation maybe the best. And Finland is not comparable, for example, with the Baltic states, which are tiny and don't really have their own defense capacities, and which of course are entirely like dependent on NATO for their defense. So that's like a really big difference between Finland and like other neighboring NATO states or next to Russia, which is important always to like emphasize that that's the case for Finland. And also one thing that that is also like often misleadingly reported is the impact of Russian retaliation attempts, I'd say, because I mean, Russia has now shut off both the electricity and natural gas supplies to Finland. And that was, of course, also like huge news internationally. And there was kind of like this presumption that it will be a huge problem for Finland. I was actually even asked in a German interview whether Finland may end up withdrawing its application because of these retaliation tactics. And nothing could be really like further from the truth. Finland is so well prepared that like neither the electricity trick nor turning off the gas tap like really impacted Finland that much. Finland only imported like about 10% of electricity from Russia, and that has already easily been substituted from the Baltic and from the Nordic electricity markets. Finland will also probably be self-sufficient on electricity soon, like maybe even already next year. And also the fact, which really often is kind of misreported, there's this like very intriguing number that Finland used to import almost like maybe something more than 90% of natural gas from Russia. So of course, that sounds like a lot and a terrible dependency, but natural gas only accounted for approximately 5% of the whole energy consumption or the whole energy portfolio. And it was mainly, or it's been mainly used in industries, and not really like very, very like little of the natural gas went into, for example, heating houses. So it's a huge difference to, for example, Germany or some other Central European states in that regard. So it was also not like really a huge problem, especially now that it happened while we're going towards summer. So neither of these actions by Russia resulted in much more than some headlines. And also we had like a couple of months time to prepare for everything. also because of the kind of volatile behavior of Gazprom already since last summer. There were already signs that something's up, and a lot of companies in Finland already started like to look for alternatives for real. And there's always been this, like, it's been always clear that that an energy dependence on Russia would be like really dangerous to Finland, and that's why we never went there. And I think there's like a fundamental misconception about that. Like a lot of other European states, for example, who have a way higher dependence on Russian energy, can't like imagine that someone actually had that much foresight. So I think that's always really important to emphasize.
Those are very good correctives to some popular misconceptions, and I appreciate that. Henry, let me close out on Finland before we close overall with Sweden. Let me close out on Finland here with a forward-looking question for you. There is remarkable, if not unity, at least a great deal of common perspective right now in Finnish government and public circles on NATO membership. What does that mean going forward? Does that allow some space for political parties to come together on some other issues that have previously been contentious? Or is this something that is very much reserved to the defense and international sphere?
Well, I would say that one must always remember when it comes to Finnish foreign policy, and especially the practice of this particular political domain, is that Finns traditionally seek consensus on foreign security and defense policy issues. Mm-hmm. And I think this is due to, of course, Finland's tradition of being a small state, where Finns have generally considered it a virtue of for not having several separate foreign policy stances on crucial issues, that it's actually a sign of strength to have unanimity in foreign policy. And I think in it's also, especially in the NATO membership issue, it's about democratic legitimacy. Because one must also remember that if you look at the Finnish constitution, we actually did not require this very thorough parliamentary process in order to get Finland into NATO. If you look at the constitution, we could actually have just had the president and the government say that we're going to send the application and that's it. But I think in this case, this was about acknowledging the fact by all the parties, the government, the president, and also acknowledging the people, that this is going to be a big change and a big decision on foreign security and defense policy. And therefore, you want to have this as inclusive as possible. You want to have the parliament and thus the people committed into this decision. And it was also a way to avoid the risky referendum, because, you know, NATO asks for a candidate country to indicate its full support, majority support for the membership. Now, it doesn't define how you indicate the support. It's up to the applying country to do that.
Okay.
And in Finland's case, I think there was a lot of talk about having a referendum before NATO membership became actually acute. And I think there were now polls later on in Finland after the attack saying that even over 50% of people did not want to have a referendum on the issue, that they trusted foreign policy leadership on this. So I would say that this is a very Finnish project to do this thoroughly, inclusively, democratically, almost a sort of a lawyer finesse work here, that when Finland enters NATO, and if we, for example, would have had very serious repercussions and retaliation by Russia, that everybody would remain committed to the process, especially the parliament. And I think in this case, we also have to remember that at the end of the day, when it comes to ratifying NATO membership, then the parliament's role will be constitutionally important, because the parliament will eventually ratify Finland's NATO membership after it's been ratified in all member states. So therefore, I think the leadership in Finland also wanted to make sure that when we go around the ratification and application process at the end of the day, that the parliament will support this process all the way. And also that nobody can come afterwards say that Finland joined NATO through a secret backdoor without consulting the parliament or taking into account the people's view on this issue. So in this sense, I would say this was a typical exercise by Finnish foreign security policy, which probably, unfortunately, will not lead into a stronger harmony and consensus on other domestic policy issues in this case.
Thank you. And I'll close with you, Emmanuel, to talk about the Swedish parallel to that. So I assume that Sweden, its parliament, will also have to ratify accession to NATO. But there is one obstacle in the way. The elephant in the room, as the phrase goes, is actually the NATO country in the room, which is Turkey, which has raised objections to Swedish and Finnish membership in NATO due to its own political concerns. And I'm hoping you can shed some light on that from a Swedish perspective and how serious you think the Turkish obstacle is and how it will be overcome in conjunction with any ultimate parliamentary vote on actually joining NATO.
Well, when it comes to an eventual parliamentary vote on NATO accession, I think the support will be substantial. There are only two parties in the Swedish parliament right now, among eight in total, who oppose Swedish NATO membership. And those are the Left Party, the former communists, and the Green Party. Right. And those represent about a little less than 15% of voters. So the support is great, and that shows in polls as well. But when it comes to Turkey, I mean, it is an obstacle that has already delayed Sweden's negotiations. I think there's a Swedish and Finnish delegation in Ankara today and I know that President Niinistö and the Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson have both spoken to Erdogan over the phone in the past few days to try and assess what demands Turkey has. I think there are some demands that are just out of the question. I think that there is no way that Sweden will extradite, especially Swedish citizens, to Turkey, and that is not a political decision to make. That's up to the judiciary, and the judiciary is independent. So that is not something that I think that we'll see at all. But there may be other concessions being made from the Swedes and the Finns. Maybe there will be. We will drop our arms embargo vis-a-vis Turkey, for example, and maybe Sweden will change our stance when it comes to the support for YPJ, the Kurdish group that I know that the Social Democrats in the current government has had some relationship with. That remains to be seen. But you know, it's hard to know really to what extent this issue with Turkey has to do with Sweden and Finland, and to what extent it has to do with Erdogan's domestic situation in Turkey with the rampant inflation and all the other issues that he's dealing with. There, from my understanding, this was not something that was raised by Turkey in preliminary talks with Sweden and Finland before they handed in their NATO application. So it may be that Erdogan is using this opportunity to negotiate some concessions that will strengthen his popularity in Turkey. And we've seen this in the past, for example, when Turkey used its veto for a few months to block new NATO defense plans for Poland and the Baltic states. And eventually they received some concessions. And I think that's what we'll see in this case as well. But I don't think that it will, of course, already has delayed the Swedish and Finnish NATO accession process, but I don't think that it will completely block it. So I'm hoping for a solution, but I've heard from both the Swedish and Finnish side that this may take, you know, it may take some time, but I think we'll find a solution eventually with Turkey.
Well, let's leave it there for now, but I look forward to speaking with each of you about many of these issues going forward. Thank you all for joining me on the Lawfare podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get our other podcasts, Chatter, Rational Security, The Aftermath, Allies, and Lawfare Noble on all major podcast platforms. And you can get ad-free versions of some of those podcasts by becoming a supporter of Lawfare, a material supporter, at patreon.com/lawfare. This podcast is edited by Jen Pacha Howell. Your audio engineer was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.